Okay. Hey.
Catch a vibe. We're gonna get you to the other side. Going you way back to the time. Reminisce and relax your mind. And catch a vibe.
Catch a vibe like a throwback. You with the bridge, about to turn it up. Picture perfect, no Kodak. And ain't no holdbacks. We getting real, getting raunchy. We bridge millennials, baby. We keep it saucy.
Welcome back to the Bridge Millennial Podcast. The Bridge Podcast is the shared perspective of the Bridge Millennial generation on culture, media, mental health, and society. Welcome back to part two of our last episode. I'm Shannon Ashlea.
Yes, yes. I am Rob here in the building. We also got a special guest coming back for a second time around. We got Sam here. Everybody clap for Sam.
Sam Sinclair, the glitch homie, the original glitch homie, OG.
OG, period.
Period, poo. And yeah, we're just going to jump right into Red Light District. Let's get sexy. Bound chicka wow wow.
I want to be touched and feel it so much because everybody needs some good loving. Yeah, if I need it in the morning or the middle of the night, I have to find the bed.
It's about to get a little saucy, using Rob's words. It's going to get a little sexy. Yes, a little saucy. So I want to continue the fear subject, and I want to talk about fear as it relates to relationships. I know for me, I've experienced a lot of dating men and dating Black men. I have experienced a lot of fear from the other party. And sometimes I feel like it's a true hindrance to a great relationship. So I wanted to get you all's opinion on fear inside the relationship, fear inside the bedroom, and everything in between. For me, lately, as a single in the dating scene, I find that while trying to get close to somebody and kind of let your guard down, you have to be vulnerable. And I find that dating, it's not even post-pandemic because the pandemic is still a reality, but yeah, dating during the pandemic has been really fear driven. I feel like on one hand, you have people who are trying to like literally get married tomorrow because they don't know what's going to happen in their world. And then they're driven by that fear. And then I, on the other hand, have experienced people who just have that fear of getting close to somebody and letting their guard down. And I find it to be really hard and just kind of discouraging as a single right now. So I wanted to know you guys' take on that.
Okay. Personally, I can relate. I think I feel that fear as well. What you're describing is like a vulnerable type of fear, like fear of being vulnerable, or maybe there's some trust that might be there. The interesting thing about fear, though, is that there are different types of fear that all kind of, when it comes to relationships and situations, they all kind of go into the soup. So even though the fear may be something as simple as like opening up or getting close to someone, the ingredients of that fear could stem from so many different things, you know? But I think overall, fear is a healthy communicator. Anytime I work with my clients, I tell them all the time, your emotions are signaling and communicating something to you that is important. So there is some learning and some lessons there. You know, we always speak about our fear like, oh, you have to overcome fear, or I have no fear. But you can have a relationship with that fear and you can reason with it and understand it and ask yourself, why is it here? What am I afraid of? Why am I that afraid? And I feel like once you start having those conversations, it's not that you'll never feel the fear, but you'll understand it a little bit more and it won't be as overwhelming. You know, especially in situations like relationships, I am one of those people that I have a fear of abandonment. So I have an instinct where I want to feel out a relationship and kind of create a roadmap almost, but I have to reason with that fear and say, okay, well, that's not healthy. What's the worst that can happen? I do have to take a chance. I do have to open up. So the fear and I have our own dialogue that allows me to be a better person in my actual life with the dating and the personal things. It's just important not to let the fear govern your decision making, because the foundation of how you connect in a relationship is going to be based in fear.
I agree. I definitely have that. I have fear of abandonment, for real. And I think that the cheers to fear of abandonment. I feel like the way that I've navigated relationships, especially in my 20s, was definitely governed by that. And it manifested itself in not taking enough space from my partners because of the fear of, I don't know, them becoming uninterested, or mm-hmm. the fear of them maybe leaving or cheating or whatever. That goes into communication and how often I communicate with somebody who is my partner. And really, I think that it's a relationship by relationship basis when it comes to communication. But for me, like, I had found myself like, you get the cut all, you ain't text me in the last 5 hours, like, it's an issue. And I really had to like sit back and be like, why is this an issue?
Yeah,
you know. So
growth and maturity, those are those growing pains, but it is important, you know. You got to take those steps, you got to make those risks. And I don't know, it's something about your 30s. You get sick of yourself. Like, you just
hell yeah.
You get sick of your shit. Like, you know, so you'd be like, I'm not gonna keep doing this. No, like, it has not worked for the past 10 years. We're gonna do something different.
Mm-hmm. For me, I honestly think everybody has a little bit of a fear of abandonment in a sense. Because nobody, you know, as much as some people will say like, oh, I'm a loner, nobody really wants to be alone by force. You know, you mm-hmm. want to be alone by choice, not because it's something that you're forced into. Mm-hmm. So, but for like relationship, I would say that I think fear is always present, in any relationship. And for me personally, like my new kind of thing now that I'm working through is fear of change as it pertains to, like, especially when you're in a relationship with somebody for a very long time, you both change over time. You become different versions of yourself over time. And then when you put kids in the mix, that also changes things too. So really just learning how to navigate that change, the fear of not knowing how something is going to play out until it actually happens. Like, for example, I just had my son 7 months ago. And while I was pregnant, one of my fears was like, okay, well, you know, when I had my first son, I was pretty young. So it's like, I got energy. You know, if you're going to get down, we're going to get down. Like, mm-hmm. ain't no problem. Like, we here, you know? Mm-hmm. But you get older, you're tired all the time. Without the baby, you're tired, you know? So you throw the baby in the mix. Now you're like, all right, how is this going to change our relationship going forward? You know, like, I still have to make sure that we're being, you know, we're able to feed each other relationally, intimately. But how does that change? What does that look like after there's now a newborn in the picture? And just kind of just being afraid. Body changes. That's something that I'm dealing with too right now. So it's like, okay, my body has changed some more. So fearing like, okay, is this person still going to accept me? Is this, and it's not even that there's any, it's not even that the person has ever made you feel like, mm-hmm. I'm not checking for you if you gain an extra 20 pounds. But just your own personal.
Yeah, you got to get comfortable 30s, in a new body.
You know? So that fear of just change and being able to find comfort in your person, even when you become a different version of yourself. And also fearing like, dang, if this person, because everybody likes to say like, oh, you know, vows sound cute. I'm actually a firm believer now. We didn't do that, but if we do like some type of renewal or something, I'm definitely going to make sure I write my own vows, because I feel like the cliche rendition of vows is like,
it's, you gotta very make generic. It personal. It's very, yeah, very generic. It's very generic.
You know, you got to make it personal, because it's just like, yo, like, people will say the for better, for worse part. And then when it comes up, everybody's like,
yeah. What I does said that
worse,
mean?
But what's that worse? I'm not too sure about that worse, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, it's just really that fear of just like, there's going to be different versions of you in your 20s, in your 30s, in your 40s, in your 50s, yes. You know, just hoping. It's really just a hope. You can never be sure, because you can never control somebody else's heart, you know? So just hoping that while you're in that evolution and while that other person is in their own evolution, that you both are still able to find that common ground, that love is still sufficient enough to cover those changes.
Yeah.
I feel like a certain level of fear, like Rob said, is healthy, because I feel like it, no shade, it keeps you on your toes, you know?
That's like literally what I just thought, yep.
Yeah. Like you said, like, not that your partner would ever make you feel like things would be different, let's say if you changed, but just having that in your mind, and sometimes you're changing for the better, but things like body changes and stuff like that, I feel like having a healthy fear might be a little bit good, because it can serve as motivation.
Yeah.
Because that fear, right, that fear is coming from somewhere. Most of the time it's coming from inside of you and something that you're actually not okay with. So if that is just like, you know, bouncing back after a baby, you know, not to put extreme pressure on you, because a mom, that's a beautiful thing. Being a mom is a beautiful thing. Like, especially being a mom of two, I admire you so much, because I hope and pray and wish to be a mom. So I think it's a beautiful thing, but I also feel like it's powerful to take that fear and to turn it into action and to turn it into just a remedy for whatever it is that you're feeling, because there are things that you do have control over. And I think that fear reminds you of what you have control over.
Yeah.
And what you don't.
Yeah. No, and that's that's a big fact, because funny enough, so back to the whole body image situation, you know, obviously if you have body image insecurities, there are going to be intimacy issues, because who's going to want to be intimate if they're not feeling themselves? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I was younger, I didn't really have too much of that thought, because I was slim and 125 pounds and I ain't got no rolls nowhere. It's all good, you know? So I wasn't thinking about lingerie and dressing up and doing all this other extra stuff. Now, because I'm in a different phase of my life and baby's here, body changes is here, it's just like, okay, well, all is not lost. You can still... do a little something, you know. Spice, so now I'm looking at stuff, I'm like, okay, like, let me try this, let me, you know, let me slip this on and see. So that it's really that fear, like, just like you said, that fear kind of sometimes can serve as a motivator, you know. Because otherwise I'll just be like, well, it is what it is, you just gonna have to like it. And it's just like, you can't do that though, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that fear is like, okay, you got some level of control over this. Some of it you don't, but do what you can. You know what I mean? So if that is to, if getting some negligee is what makes you feel powerful and what boosts your confidence in to get you in that mood, then do that.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Do that.
Absolutely. That type of fear that we're talking about now is like, can be classified as like a self-conscious fear or like an ego fear. So people who deal with that type of fear, the ultimate fear is that there's a damage to the ego. The crazy thing about that fear is that it's the one that we live with minute to minute. And although it's a fear of diminishing value, it ironically makes life worth living, because that kind of defensiveness that you have makes you challenge the way you think about yourself, makes you challenge the way that you think about others. And it creates an internal conflict where you're eventually, well, hopefully you're growing from it. But that type of fear is also really, it caters to the psychological aspects of discrimination, gang mentality, sabotage, and it plays into this sense of superiority and comparing your values or your quality against another standard. So there's like a generalized statement that doesn't, it's not stated about you, but because of how the world functions, there is an implied statement that you identify with. Mm-hmm. So those are, though, I feel like that's like one of the most common things that we live with every minute. That's why people lie so much. That's why people hide.
Yeah.
The average person per conversation, I think, tells, I think it was like 6 or 7 lies per 15 minutes of conversation, in the regards that not necessarily saying things to be misleading, but filtering your thoughts and not saying what you really think or not saying how you really feel because you're concerned about how it's going to come off. You don't want to show a certain side of yourself. So there is this invasion of privacy thing that we kind of grow into, and it helps us learn this personal space, what is mine and what's yours and where my personal bubble is. So having that fear is a very human and self-preservering type of thing that it serves a good purpose in telling us boundaries. It tells us where jurisdiction is. It tells us where our power is in terms of change. It helps us accept the things that we can't change, you know?
Yeah.
Serenity. So Yes.
You want serenity? Yeah.
You already know.
I'm hip. You know, it's really interesting because as a child and even now as an adult, I never looked at like fear in that way as far as, you know, filtering yourself and filtering your thoughts. I actually had like an opposite approach. And so, you know, as a child and even as an adult, like it's been a little harder to relate to people and to make friends because in my mind, there's no point in me holding anything back from who I am. And I find that to be more an outlier than anything else. So I always kind of felt different in that way because that's not quote unquote normal, you know, that's abnormal. And for me as an adult, I would say that it's increased, you know, I do now care what people think of me and how I'm perceived in the world. And that just kind of happened with time. And I feel like it happened with experience. And one thing that I admire about kids, and one of the reasons why I still work with kids, is that, you know, they're so pure. A lot of them don't have that filter where they're afraid to share themselves. And that always is inspiring to me because kids live without a lot of fear. And, you know, they learn these fears along the way. So you have like, you know, 2 and 3 year olds like doing some crazy stuff. You know, you'll find some stories of a 2 and a 3 year old. They're going to walk up to the roof because they don't have that fear, you know, and it's obviously really dangerous, but they don't know that.
To them, it's they sitting on top of the world. They just up
it's
there.
Right, up so.
Right. And it's really, I feel like it's life that kind of brings you down. And I mean, it should, because that's dangerous. But in other ways, I feel like life brings you down in other ways, psychologically. And I don't think that's always a good thing. I think that to a certain extent it is, but then you have it reminds me of, we're going to move back to Rugrats. It reminds me of Chucky. He has an irrational fear of literally everything. And you know, that's just kind of like how some adults live their life to this day. So it's really tough in trying to build relationships like that. It's almost impossible. Lasting relationships and
lasting.
Keyword lasting.
Yeah.
And I think that's that. And I say that because a lot of people being in a long-term relationship, it takes a lot more intentionality than just dating just to date or, you know, just to hook up or whatever. Because there's certain layers of yourself that you do not have to disclose at all. You know, if you're just chilling out with somebody for 2 months, 3 months at a time, you know, but that authenticity comes to the surface over a period of time. And over a period of time spent with a person. And I don't think a lot of people like that. That bounces right back to that vulnerability. It's like the minute they feel like, wow, so this I can't even say mask because I don't want to say it as if everyone's being disingenuous, but it's just like, okay, now there are other lights that this person is going to have to see me in. Am I okay with that? You know, like, mm-hmm. especially holidays, like you find like a lot of people think, oh, holidays is so sentimental, so romantic. No, there's it's a lot hard. Of breakups that yeah. happen. Yeah. A lot yeah. of breakups that happen in the holiday season. Yeah. I feel like there's a certain, like, when you're considering people's family, being around family members and just certain feelings that stir up around the holiday season, there's a certain level of vulnerability that comes with that. And I don't think a lot of people, especially in our generation, I don't think a lot of people like that vulnerability. It's yeah. it's scary. It's that it's you can't control, because you can't control how the other person responds yeah. to that part of yourself that you're about to unveil. Right. You know? Yeah. So that's also that fear of rejection too. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I'm about to show you this part of myself, and it's literally the ball is in your court of whether you yes. accept it or not. And it's scary.
Yeah.
You know?
That type of fear is what you would consider like a calculated fear. And that's typically like a common sense feeling, or like a gut feeling of failure, feeling of regret, or rejection. Calculated fear is like based on the psychological assumption about what the gain or loss is in the risk that you're about to take, if that makes sense. So it can be felt in things like taking a chance on someone in a relationship, gambling, moving to a new city, performing on stage, about to take a test. All of those things forces the likelihood of whether things will turn out good or bad. And it forces you to ask the question, is this risk worth taking in the first place?
Yeah, and I find it to be dating as a Black woman in 2021, I find it to be really tough because these people have these calculated fears that you may not understand. And, you know, mm-hmm. you might not have the same ones. And so that's when you have, like you said, Sam, these 2 to 3 month situationships where it's like, okay, the person's like, well, actually, this is all I'm going to give you. So,
yeah.
See you later. Like, yeah, we had a couple vulnerable moments, but that's it. I feel like that's as far as I can go. And I think it just goes back to show you that.
And that doesn't work for anybody. Nobody wins in that situation.
No, it doesn't. Nobody wins in that situation. So I find it extremely frustrating right now in my life to go through that. And of course, for me, as somebody who, because I feel like in order to love and to fall in love, you have to be a certain amount of courageous. And I feel like you have to be Gryffindor in this bitch. It's all about courage.
Great, like that.
Yeah. And I'm a Gryffindor. You heard me? But everyone isn't like that. And so I find it like just emotionally exhausting being vulnerable and then having that cutoff. Like, okay, I was vulnerable with you for a second, but now I'm done. The wall is back up. And, you know, I see you when I see you, and I won't see you and I won't say anything. Mm-hmm. And that kind of goes both ways, because if you, for me, you put the wall back up. Okay, now my wall's back up. I mean, two can play that game. So it's just, I find it very frustrating. And also when it comes to sex and intimate relationships, I feel that when you're casually dating and maybe casually hooking up, it's kind of the same thing. I also feel like sexually people have a fear of opening up. And so they're not going to tell you what they really want sexually. So it's like you start with, you know, let's say you're in a race. I mean, they already have a head start. You're not going to ever catch up because they're not going to share that information with you because of that. You know what I mean? Because of that same fear. So it's only going to last so long because you're not going to tap into what they really want sexually because they're not going to share that with you.
So. And that's so big, because a lot of times you see like relationships like, they go for a significant period of time and then they seem like everything's fine. They check all the other boxes. They're great friends. They communicate well. Well, let's because the communication be it. That'd be the kicker, because it's like, okay, so let's say you're with somebody for 5 years, right? And y'all have your own way. Y'all have had this way of how you interact with each other sexually. You claim to know what this person likes, and that person claims to know what you like. And it's really just because you've been doing the same thing for a significant period of time. That's all you know. Right. If someone else now decides and says, okay, you know what? I want to try something. Things go sideways so quickly after that, because a lot of people don't have that conversation to even be vulnerable and open up and be like, yeah, I want to try this. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you're my person. I'm not saying go hopping over all over the place and trying different things. If you have your person, you know, or your safe partner that you're, you know, having these intimate moments with, you should be able to disclose and try stuff. Because then what happens if you have a desire sexually and that person is not meeting that desire, you can't blame them because you didn't disclose it.
Yeah.
You know? So then you have one person that's unsatisfied sexually. And then that's how you start getting people start going sniffing and trying to get their itch scratched somewhere else. When it could have been avoided if you just had a conversation. But that conversation calls for vulnerability. So even in a relationship that's 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, 20 years old, that vulnerability is always going to be necessary. Yes. Always going to be necessary.
Absolutely. You see Jada, Will and Jada, they are like the subject on the internet often. Will just came out with a new book, but the way that they are vulnerable when talking about their relationship, I remember, I think Jada said on Red Table Talk, like, even after all of this time, she had to remind herself, like, she can't be mad at Will because he's not a mind reader when it comes to the bedroom. And then look at how long they've been together. Like, you know, he can't read her mind on what she wants if she doesn't express that and have that conversation. And a lot of people are trying to, like, shut them up. Like, why y'all talking about your business?
I love it.
I absolutely love it. I'm like an outlier because I'm like, you know what? You see,
I think it's
together.
Necessary.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy because for years I honestly think they kind of also in some ways, probably maybe even her more so because she's been more of the talkative one. They kind of needed to be freed from that perfection image.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like it's too much pressure you to maneuver in ways that you don't even want to maneuver.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the fact that they're coming out now and they're sharing their imperfections, I mean, I get, some things you kind of want to keep, but her mission of that even Red Table Talk was to help people.
Yeah.
So if she happened to be a subject of something that she wants to help people with, that just comes with the territory of having that kind of show. You know what I mean? And I think it's really, really, really important that their relationship, and even there's a docuseries called Black Love that I absolutely adore.
Where is it streaming?
So it's usually on, well, the new seasons, they premiere on OWN. It's an OWN series. But then the replays are on Hulu. I think seasons 1 to 4 are on Hulu right now. Okay. And it's really good because it's married couples that some you don't know, some you know, some are like popular, you know, you're like, oh yeah, I know them. I know Viola Davis was on it. I don't know if you know Deval Ellis and Kadeen Ellis. They're like a YouTube sitcom family. They're on it. Like, a lot of people that you know, you see, like, they're on it, and they have this, they kind of shatter this perfect image of what relationship and marriage looks like, and they get into like the nitty-gritties of it and the highs and the lows of it and the compromise that it takes and all the versions of themselves that they go through, some divorced and got back together, and all of that is literally part of it. So when I see them getting yanked to and fro on social media because Jada said something, and you know, these hyper masculine guys is in their bag about it, and you know, that sense of pride. Oh, you making Will look like a punk. All of that is like, it's so not superficial. Relevant, yeah. Like, it's so superficial. Like, these are the conversations that need to be had. Absolutely. Yeah. Especially for our community. Like, a lot of us grew up in households where mom and dad wasn't married, or maybe they were married, but it wasn't even a healthy relationship. So we have such skewed ideas of what a relationship looks like, what a healthy relationship looks like. And unfortunately, a lot of people look to the internet and look to these celebrities for that idea of perfection.
Yeah.
Oh, couple goals and relationship goals. And it's like, it's not necessarily that their goals, it's that they fit that perfect mold that you didn't have. You know what I mean? So you're clinging to this image of perfection because you didn't have anything in your household that even looked remotely close to it, you know? So it's fulfilling whatever fantasies you have of what you wanted a healthy relationship or a parental, you know, unit to look like. So I really think that what they got going on right now, as maybe as uncomfortable as it might seem for them, it's absolutely, absolutely necessary. And I think people should spend more time focusing on the lessons that they can get from their experiences, even as they unfold in real time, instead of just trying to, oh, that don't sound good, and she should have kept that to herself, and he should have kept it. Learn from it. It's such valuable information.
It really goes to show you the unhealthy nature of what the Black community thinks an ideal relationship should look like. And that, to me, is, I feel like, a bigger problem. Because, come on, Rob, what you got?
Listen, I've said this time and time again to the Black community. When it comes to healthy relationships, almost getting there doesn't count. When it comes to developing a healthy relationship with your child, almost doesn't count. When it comes to having a healthy sexual relationship with your partner, almost does not count. You can't almost meet the mark with somebody. But for us generationally, almost is all we had.
Yeah.
Almost is our culture. That's what we know. And so it becomes a comfort. We're comfortable with it. We've desensitized ourselves to like the almost, and we're comfortable with it. So we forget that it's not normal and it's not expected, but it's good enough for us. So when we do almost for somebody else, it's good enough for them. And we wonder like, well, what else am I supposed to do? I gave you almost, like, what? Why would you want more of me or anything like that? But it's actually less normal to think that way. That is coming from a place of mental illness. That's coming from cycles of mental illness where you have this protective layer. And when you develop constant conflict or static in these relationships, it's like do or die. There's so many Black families that do not forgive. Like, somebody cross somebody in a Black family, the relationship is done for life.
Forever.
And that's not healthy. But that's what we are taught. That's how we think about, you know, relationships. That approach in a particular situation at a particular time might have been helpful, but it's not a permanent thing. I think that we put these definitive pressures on things that should be more experimental. And we don't allow space for natural change. We kind of stop natural change.
It's like a one size fits all kind of situation.
And if it don't fit, whatever. That's who problem is that? We don't talk about that. We're not having that conversation. No, you're just ungrateful. You're just spoiled. You're just this. We don't think about the problem being that we have someone with a 10-gallon tank and we only have a gallon of love to give, you know?
Right.
We can't fill it because we don't have it, but that's our problem, not theirs.
Yeah, that's not an accountability issue. That's that accountability issue, even as it pertains to as what people would think simple situations like that. It's like, we're that kind of that generation that's learning to own our own stuff.
Yes.
You know? Everything's usually, oh, it's your fault, this and your fault, that. Yeah. It's like, okay, even if this person they stepped on your toe today, right? But you lashed out. Yeah, they stepped on your toe. It was wrong, but you lashed out, and the way you lashed out wasn't okay. You got to own that. You got to own that. You got to find out, why did I lash out this way? That's what you're responsible for. You know what I mean? So really just pinpointing, like, okay, yeah, somebody can offend you and they can be wrong, but there are still parts of those exchanges and those situations that you also in turn are responsible for. And it's not necessarily just to say, you know, okay, I'm just going to do this work because I want to get back on good terms with you, or, you know, people would love to, I'm not kissing nobody's ass.
And yeah,
I'm
not about that. Right.
It's not about that. For me, like, I've had significant situations where, like, even in my family, where trust and, family drama, mm-hmm. struggles, family, mm-hmm. you know, and I could have been callous. I could have been, I'm not talking to this person no more, whatever, you was wrong, and I'm justified, and da-da-da, cool, but I got kids. So I have to learn how to communicate effectively.
Yes.
Me shutting down on you and never speaking to you again, that might tickle my fancy for this particular situation, but going forward, I still got to learn how to resolve conflict effectively. You know what I mean? Especially when you have children. Especially when you have children. Like, that is absolutely necessary. And especially if you intend to be somebody that is in a meaningful relationship or a long-term relationship, those things, those skills, those tools, as far as communication, they are absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. So, like, I really had to take it as using those situations with family and kind of use it as my own training ground. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be learning this with my kid, because then they're still going to experience traumas and
they're missing out.
Hurt from me not taking the time out to deal with my own stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean? So take those opportunities and really, like, even if you're not talking to the person no more, really sit down. Like, I loved, and some people call it overthinking, but for me personally, like, I replay situations in my head all the time. Not in a way to psych myself out, but like, okay, how could I have dealt with this better? Even if the person was wrong, how could I have handled this better? Because then that helps me deal with other people in other situations in a more effective way.
Seek understanding. Yeah.
How change. Do I respond to betrayal? How do I respond to somebody lying to me? Mm-hmm. Those things are important. If mom lied to me and I I gotta learn my triggers as it pertains to somebody lying to me, as it pertains to me feeling betrayed. So when my kid comes and they do things that kids do and they lie to me, I'm not whoop on them.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? So all those things are connected. Like, learning how to effectively communicate right across the board is absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
And especially in your relationships, OMG, like, it's so necessary.
Yeah, I feel like being transparent about those triggers is really important as well, because it's one thing to realize that you have them, but to be transparent about them when you're dealing with any type of relationship, I think is really important, because it gives perspective to the other person, because they're not you. They don't know why you wild the fuck out when they said this one thing, you know? So I think being communicative and really sharing, and not oversharing, but just sharing why you reacted the way you did in a certain situation, creates that human understanding, because that's what connection is all about, realizing that we're more alike than we are different. So absolutely. Yes.
And the type of fear that we're talking about now is actually traumatic fear. And trauma-related fear is by far the most complex and complicated of any type of fear that you'll experience. But ultimately, that fear is coming from the fear of reliving a painful experience. Trauma-related fear is usually understood in two motivational factors. Either the fear drives you to avoid something at all costs, or it drives you to hurry up and get it over with. Mm. So situations related to trauma fear, they are described as triggers, like we said, and those are incidents that subconsciously raise your firewall. So it reminds you of an experience that you've already had, and you react to them faster than you can process it in effort to keep that memory suppressed or keep that memory distant. So when you are finding yourself reacting to those triggers as if you're living them in real time, like present day, then that's called post-traumatic stress responses. trauma fear determines that you have gone through something that your brain has deemed too terrible to relive. And therefore, that firewall is there to protect you. Either it's going to keep all incidents that remind you of that space away from you, or it's going to cause you to re-traumatize yourself so that you can become less sensitive to that trigger over time. And that's why when we're in cycles, it's because we're doing that. The most common thing that people will say, I'm never going to be like my mother. I'm never going to be like my parents. I'm never going to be like this. You don't think that your mother thought that about her mother and her mother thought that about her mother? That's a part of the cycle. And in order to break that, we need to have, yes, accountability, but there's also, I don't know that it's forgiveness, but it's a step of humility in understanding that even though you're the victim, not everything is about you. This dynamic happened to you, but not because of you. You were there. That's why it happened to you. But it wasn't because of you. So the question is, why did it happen? What was it because of? And so you have to step outside of yourself.
That's where that extending grace come in. And some people got mixed feelings about that. And me personally, younger me, probably, I don't gotta, you know, whatever. When you get older, like some things you're just like, bro, it's not even.
Yeah, I had a conversation with my therapist. I was like, honestly, bro, I'm not doing this for another 10 years. So like I'm not going to commit to living in a darkness place the rest of my life for what? But I do think you gotta get sick of it. I had an issue with forgiveness. I think I still kind of struggle with forgiveness, but I'm getting better at understanding it now because there's a dialogue that you have with yourself in the forgiveness process and being able to, and Will Smith actually said this recently, he said, you can't punish people for making mistakes. Being able to understand that your bad experience was the product of someone else's mistake, which was the product of someone else's mistake, which was the product of someone else's mistake. So the best thing that you can do to heal from it is understand that it wasn't personal, but also understand how not to affect others that way, you know?
Word, because there's always a root and more roots. And just like we know the roots on the tree, they go on forever. Roots under, I mean, they're everywhere. There's so many, you can't really decipher one from another. So I mean, that makes a lot of sense. It all comes from somewhere,
and it ties right back into the vulnerability and the fear, bringing it full circle. Like, yo, fear is definitely, it's not something that we can escape as humans. We can try to manage it as best we can, but it's not something that we can escape. But we have to find a healthy way to be able to decipher between what's healthy fear, what's irrational fear, and stuff like that. Because that, with fear, vulnerability and fear go hand in hand. You know what I mean? So you can't say, oh, I'm just not going to be afraid of anything. And you're not really being cognizant of the fact that, yeah, cool, that's fine. You skydive and you drag race and you do all these things, but when it comes to being vulnerable, you can't do that. That's not fair, you know? And that vulnerability leads to conversations, you know, and sharing experiences that can help whoever you are in a relationship with understand how you tick and understand you a little bit better. You know what I mean? From my experience with me and my husband, like, I only begun being able to forgive him to a certain extent for like certain mannerisms or stuff like that after having deep conversations with him about his own experiences. And then it's just like, oh.
Yeah, so it starts to make sense.
XYZ, and then that's when you begin to separate yourself from the experience. Like, you didn't do this to me because it's me.
You did this
because of a experience that you had, and that's, I'm just basically, and it sounds a little sounds a little negative, but I'm just basically collateral damage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's not personal to me. And mm-hmm. when you do that, you're able to, because let me tell you something. People, I'm not gonna forgive and da 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 and oh whatever. Listen, that's how people hold grudges. They don't forgive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those grudges, that's not doing nothing for nobody. And not I'm not saying all. You gotta forgiving somebody does not equal access, right?
No, yeah,
you can still have those boundaries. And if that's a person that you decide, okay, I'm better not having contact with that person, then that's fine.
Yeah,
but you still gotta let it go.
Yeah,
you still have to release it. Or else you're gonna walk around
with it,
just like carrying
and
that,
and it bleeds into everything you do,
and that trauma bleeds into all,
and it becomes a trigger.
Yeah,
it becomes a trigger
cycle.
Trigger when I hit. That's in my head right now. Like trigger. Like yes, like Janae, she got it with that one, because that song been in my head this whole conversation. it's a vicious cycle, and it starts with fear. And y'all, we have to really just go head to head with our fears. We're going to have them, but like be honest about them and be open and vulnerable with people that you care about and people that you want to have a relationship with, whether that's family, whether that is friends, and whether that is a significant other or a potential partner. It's really, really important to be able to move forward. So yeah, I mean, damn, that got deep as hell.
Yeah.
That got hella deep. Rob, do you have any more for us on fear?
Yes, I'm gonna swing us into mental health and society. I got like some, you know, some little tasty about fear.
Little snaggity snack.
Some little something to snack on.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Okay, so jumping into, we basically covered like what I would break down fear into four types. We covered three out of the four. We already talked about traumatic fear. We talked about calculated fear, and we talked about self-conscious fear. But one of the oldest fears is evolutionary fear. So there's this experiment by the psychologists Eleanor J. Gibson and Richard Walk at Cornell University, and it's called the Visual Cliff Experiment. And the reason why they did this experiment is because they wanted to investigate depth perception in human animal species. So in this experiment, they had an infant, and there was a surface. Think of like, I guess, like a really big table. And you put this infant on this huge table. So part of the table was solid. It was like checker patterned. And then a part of the table, half of it was like plexiglass. It was see-through. So to the baby did not know that there was a surface there that they could crawl on. They assumed it was like the edge of a cliff. And what we learned in this experiment, they had the mom on the other side of the table, you know, trying to get the baby to come. But the baby would go right up until the solid part and would not go like on the glass part because the baby was scared of falling. And what this taught us is that there are very evolutionary fears that's coded in our DNA that protects us as animals that we kind of pass down. Another example of that type of an evolutionary fear would be, think about if y'all ever saw like food molded. Right. I'm not talking a little spot. I'm talking getting busy, hairy situation. Like, you know what I mean? Mm. 9 out of 10 times, if you have to throw it in the garbage, we pick that thing up like this. We be like,
yeah,
you know,
we're not trying to touch that.
Yeah. So that is that's also an evolutionary fear that was built into us. That's called intuitive microbiology. And it makes us react that way to things that are likely sources of infection. So when we see things that kind of give us creepy crawly vibes, it's usually because our DNA is recognizing that that's a biological threat to our health. That's also why things smell bad that are typically bad for us. Also why you can really rely on taste. Typically, if you have a taste for certain things, like certain foods, it indicates that your body needs that particular substance. A less creepy example is like when a woman is pregnant, if she's anxious in public, she'll unconsciously use her arms and hands to shield her stomach. And that's also an evolutionary thing that is passed on actually through the hormones of the baby. The baby has, babies are like witchcraft. Like they got a lot of fail safes. Babies are actually born with like nearly perfect symmetry because they're meant to be cute and attractive so that we can fall in love with them and want to hold them and protect them. So it's like they're fail-safe, as well as the way that they smell. Mm-hmm. That baby smell is also something that's supposed to draw you in, and it helps you protect oxytocin. That baby. Yeah, and so once the baby is grown out of that stage, they stop producing that hormone, that smell again. So that was really an interesting jump on that. But I do want to give you guys a really quick, like, pass down. You know how families be passing down those little lessons? Mm-hmm. I'm going to give y'all a little pass down lesson, right? Okay. So my mother would tell me that her mother's mother, you know, would always, like, when she cook a chicken, she would always cut off the head of the chicken and cut off one leg of the chicken and then cook the chicken. So my mother's mother, which would be my grandmother, she would do the same thing. She would cut off one foot, cut off the head. She was taught that that's how you're supposed to cook the chicken. So when it come down to my mother forgot to cut off the head and the leg of the chicken, and she freaked out. So it was like this big alarm, like, oh my God, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? So she calls her mom and was like, hey, mom, I forgot to cut off the like head and the chicken. What's going to happen? And my grandmother's like, well, nothing's going to happen. I did it because my mother did it. And my mother did it because the whole chicken couldn't fit in the pot.
Oh.
Right. So sometimes we inherit these mannerisms and we encode a fear into our DNA that is actually a cultural phobia that has no foundation, but we pass on these things because this is how we teach the normal to our children. When you teach children what normal is, you adversely teach them to fear everything outside of what you showed them to be normal.
That's so crazy.
If you show them that this is like this, 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 and these are how things are supposed to be, and they're supposed to be like this all the time, when they encounter a world where things are not like that, that is what they're going to be afraid of. That's going to give them anxiety. That's going to stress them. So it's really important, like you said earlier, Sam, in our previous segment, that you have to really come to terms with that as much of your own psychological fears as you can. Regardless of the type of fear that you're dealing with, the approach is generally the same in how to handle it. You ask yourself, why do I feel this way? And why do I feel this strongly about it right now? And so that is the window for you to open up that dialogue with yourself and understand, what is it that your fear is signaling to you? Mm. And is it appropriate? We have in therapy, we use this ABC chart, which is antecedent behavior consequence. So the antecedent will be the thought that you have leading to what behavior. Okay, so I didn't put the chicken in a pot. Okay, so now I'm freaking out because I think something's going to happen. And then what is the consequence of those things? And then at the end of you creating that pattern, you go to D, which is discuss. Was your reaction appropriate to this situation? Mm. Was that reaction called for right now? So because you were in an argument and somebody raised their voice at you, you are feeling like you're ready to cut somebody. Mm. Okay. Now, raising the voice was the trigger. The behavior was, I want to cut somebody. What's the consequence of that? Okay, somebody's going to be cut. I might go to jail or something like that. I don't know. So now we have that dialogue. When this person today raised their voice at you, did that warrant your reaction? Or were you reacting to something that was not existing right now? And how do you then negotiate with situations like that? So now that we know, when someone raised their voice, you're going to want to pull out a machete. Mm. Now, we need to figure out, how do we exist in a world where people will raise their voice, but you don't pull out the machete?
Yes.
because you're pulling out the machete because of something that happened to you when you was a child years ago, but you're no longer in that space. Those elements no longer exist. That is no longer a possibility right now. So how do we appropriately respond to what's happening right now? But before you can approach that, you have to think, how am I feeling and why do I feel so strongly? And then all of those other questions tend to follow. So that's what I have for you guys on mental health and society. I was so happy to share with you guys that experiment. I remember when I learned about it in school, I was just like, what? And we got to actually see the experiment play out with a bunch of different babies, which honestly, back in the day, the way that they learned things psychologically was kind of like messed up. Like, are we really trying to traumatize a bunch of babies?
Yeah.
But that was that experiment. Yeah.
It's good. It's really good. It's really good. And I think our generation does a lot of that questioning mm-hmm. of like the example with the chicken and the one leg and the head. Mm-hmm. Nobody questioned it. Yeah. I just did what the other person did. You know what I mean? But I feel like because our generation, we're the ones to be like, okay, wait, hold up. Why are you telling me to do this? Mm-hmm. For them, it's just like, what you mean?
Yeah.
This is how we always question things. Okay, but why is this how you like? There are so many old folk tales of like doing this, that, and it's only annoying and irritating to me right now because I have a newborn, and the amount of things that you will hear, don't do this, don't do that, don't tickle them on the bottom of their feet or they're gonna stutter. Don't let them see their reflection in the mirror because they're gonna see ghosts. What else? If they have hiccups, put two matches sticks and a cross in their hair, or wet like a thread with some saliva and put it on their forehead. Like things that I saw my mom do with my siblings, things that we did with my older son. And my newborn, I'm like, bro, I'm not doing that. Like, what are you talking? I'm not doing that. Like, so he's teething right now, and I saw the tooth come up. So I was on the phone with my grandma, and I'm like, oh, you know, whatever. His tooth popped out. Oh, you're not supposed to say tooth. You're supposed to call it carrot.
What? Like, you know what?
I'm like, okay. What are you talking about? Oh, you're not supposed to look in his mouth and see his teeth, because if you do that, it's going to take longer to come out.
There's a lot of old wives' tales going on here, it seems.
And see, it's like, for those, it's like, okay, those are funny, but just imagine how many other
They're funny now, but at some point that was actually valid, and that could have been connected to an actual something that was happening at the mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of The Crucible, where at the time it was like people are yelling witch, there's like these reports of witchcraft and stuff like that, there's these hallucinations, but there was something going on with the crops that actually mm-hmm. was poisonous and mm-hmm. caused mm-hmm. those witchcraft behaviors and symptoms.
But at the time they weren't able to detect. They weren't able to detect stuff like that at the time.
They created their own. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what we was talking about in the beginning with vital information, how things happen and people just throw their narrative in it, mm-hmm. and then just pass that information down. Like, we're having tornadoes because somebody looked at a baby's mouth. Like,
okay,
the climate change. So we're having tornadoes. Like,
but I mean, that's really how history is passed down orally. So, I mean, mm-hmm. you have to really be careful about the things that you say, especially publicly. And mm-hmm. I think that's probably the reason why millennials question so many things right now, because everything is on such a public platform. And so it's mm-hmm. like, well, wait a minute. Now, these people aren't just saying these things to, you know, their children. They're not just passing these things on to their children. They're saying things for the whole world to hear. In 2 seconds, the entire internet has heard it. And now it's like, wait, what was that? Like, why? And now, you know, with the click of a couple thumbs, you can find out on Google if there's any actual fact to the things that people are saying. So I think that's probably why we are the questioning generation, because we are the generation that grew up with the internet and the growth of the internet. So because of that, it's like we have these questions and now we can actually get them answered. And I think that's the big difference. And that's what makes us different. And that's why like this whole podcast is even a thing, because our generation does have a different perspective, because it's like, we're not just going by what we were told. You know, we are actually doing research. We're actually challenging a lot of the things that we grew up on. And I think it's really fucking cool. So, shout out to us. Shout out to us and necessary, you know. These old wives' tales, I feel like stuff like that, you know, they're passed on from generation to generation. But at some point, they will be. At some point. It's got to be over at some point. It has to be debunked, and we have to move forward into actual vital information that you need to live your life, to be a mother, to be successful, to have a family, or whatever that may be. So,
I think naturally, new information should breed new understandings, which should breed new actions and new ways of living. But when it comes to like that Generation X and the boomers, people don't realize how new this world really is and how far we are. We're not really that far removed from some very fucked up things. There's still like, I think some of what motivates people to stick to tradition and hold on to the past, even though it doesn't make sense, is because when you justify a new understanding, you also have to take accountability for your actions and how you contributed to that past understanding. It's not just as simple as saying, okay, I'm not racist anymore and Black people should be treated equal and shouldn't be judged by the color of their skin. No, great granddad. By admitting that, you also need to admit all of the fucked up things that you personally have done. And how do you then reconcile those? And you see that even in like families passing on generational trauma, passing on conditions, passing on these normal things. When you realize, like, if you grew up in poverty, and you grew up not having three meals a day and having to go find free meal here and free meal there, that is a circumstance, but admitting that that circumstance is not healthy is also admitting that you as a parent was not providing for your child, which if you feel like that's all you could do, it's hard to like swallow that pill. You want to believe, okay, I did my best, but, and the kid is like, you know, mom did their best or dad did their best. But like I said, almost does not count. So you can't almost be mentally healthy. You can't almost have a healthy relationship. It's either you have a healthy situation or it's an unhealthy situation. So sometimes for, I think, older generations, moving into the future belief systems means, okay, now that you understand that things are different, you also have to understand that you were wrong. This whole time you were wrong and you stood strong and wrong, but you were wrong.
And it's all you knew, but now you know different.
Now you know different. It's time for you to forgive yourself, but it's also time for you to, I guess, seek forgiveness in some ways of the things that you've done. You know,
it's crazy because a lot of the times we're a lot more forgiving of them than they are of themselves. You know, we're more understanding of it and really willing to look past it and be like, okay, no, you did what you could with the tools that you had. You know, you did what you could with the level of understanding that you had.
Millennials, we come from Generation X and boomers. And during that whole Generation X time, not only were most of them raising themselves, but also there was this movement of raising the perfect child. There was this, you get your child involved in this, this, and this, make them well-rounded, have encyclopedias in the house. It was in their idea, they were responsible for designing
your life,
perfect member of society.
Build a kid.
So, and it was like in their head, they weren't even catering to a kid. It was like, I'm going to design this adult that's going to be able to handle themselves, that's going to be on the cutting edge of innovation. And they did that, but their whole mission in life was to raise a perfect child. That was what their mission was. And we were an extension of their success. We were like their midterm. We were their final. We were their college degree. So your outcome of your child is a reflection of you as an individual. Yeah. So yeah. That's what's different. But because we came out to be like these almost robotically intelligent, logical, innovative people, we are not, I personally feel like we're not as in touch with our emotional side because that wasn't a priority to us as a child. As a child, our priority was having certain skills. Our priority was developing certain skills. So for us, what we as millennials do best is analyze. We can analyze and improve and then analyze and then improve. Look at what we've done. We've built the internet. We've built a living robot that analyzes and improves itself. We can do that over and over and over again, but we're just now getting to the age. The oldest millennials is what, in their early, late 30s, I'm sorry?
The oldest millennials are about 39 right now. Yeah. Actually, my brother turned 40 this year. He's about the oldest millennial. He's 1981, so right. Very close.
So we're just now taking all of that information and being self-reflective. That's not stuff we're going to do in our early 20s. You're going to do it, well, unless you have a child and you have to think about those things. Mm-hmm. You're not going to think about that. The time that you're going to analyze those things is in your late 20s and your, you know, 30s. So we're the first generation of people that are actually reflecting and applying all of that innovation in the world around us on our own psychology. Because now it's how do we upgrade us?
Yeah.
And so this is the first time that that conversation is starting to happen. With our parents and grandparents, it was an opposite culture. Kids were seen but not heard. Kids did not have value of what they say. And you're not going to challenge the beliefs of this family or that. You know what I mean? So this is the first time that's happening. And I think that's why we are more forgiving and understanding than our parents is capable of.
Yeah,
because they went through their 30s already. They're done that. All of that transitional.
It's sealed. It's sealed.
Done.
It's in the sand.
It's done. It's gone.
Yeah.
It's over.
And what they knew or what they thought that they knew, the time to apply those things is kind of over for them. And so I feel like it's like if you knew better, you would do better. But
yeah.
At the same time, it's like if that's not where you are in your life, you really kind of don't need to do better because you already did it. So
we are the better that they did. This was their mission to make us. And I think a part of them knew that we needed to outrun them in the race. I don't know any children, and I'm guess I don't know, maybe Sam you can speak to that, but I don't know anyone now whose expectation is that my children have to do better than me in life. Like, I don't know. I don't really hear that conversation. But when we were born, we were designed to outrun our parents.
Absolutely.
And I think that was all they could. That's the furthest they could stretch the baton, just based off of the shit that they've come from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have the capacity, but they had vision and they saw a future that we needed to lead. And so collectively, they was like, you know what? It's too late for us, but we're going to build these little ass robot children and we're going to do that eye on that prize joint and we're going to take them through the information era. We're going to take them through a technology era. We're going to take them through innovation and they're just going to run with all of this information. And that's the best that we can do for our, you know, so.
Yeah. And I think they did a great job. I think that for my parents actually are boomers and they grew up in Jim Crow South. So for them, you know, to have my brother and I, it was definitely like, we want to afford you all the opportunities that we didn't have an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's along the lines of that. And it's great, but that doesn't mean that I have to do everything that you envision
me doing.
I have the skills. And when they are applicable,
yes,
I will use them.
But it's not a one size fits all.
It's not
absolutely not.
And even as being a millennial parent, like parenting looks a lot different for me than it did when my mom was actively parenting me. College. And it's just like, okay, cool. And I thought that was the only thing success looked like. And anything outside of college, you were an absolute disgrace. Right. Yeah. Where now I'm like, I tell my son all the time, I'm like, listen, you don't have to go to college. You can pick up a trade. We're in an era now where, especially pandemic, really kind of stretched or swung the away work field that. Back to skill.
Yes.
And not so much degree, but back to skill. So I'm like, if you pick up a trade and you're passionate about it, then you, that's fine. As long as you got a plan, we good to go. You understand me? Mm-hmm. So things, it shifts over time. And I just think we're a lot more fluid with kind of going with the way that it shifts and learning how to survive whichever way it shifts.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a bonus for us. That's our evolutionary tale. Being able to really roll with the punches as they go. It's just not something that the generations prior to us is privy on. So
we have evolved, we are more enlightened, and it's just facts. And I feel like Eckhart Tolle actually says this in his book, but as the generations progress, the next generation should be more enlightened than us. That's just the way it is, but that's the way it's supposed to be. It means that we did our job. So millennials, this is your moment. Do your job. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
And also, I shout out to the boomers, shout out to Gen X. I think that the setup that they put us on, it was rough and it was kind of cold, but it was effective. We watched the world go through the same, let's take civil rights, for example. We watched the world go through the same civil rights cycle, except this time around, the world can become aware of it like that. Like, boom. And that holds weight. That makes it like, you know what I mean? That makes that response a little bit different. So we, shout out to them. I mean, the plan was good, but now it's about, now that we are working on healing the world, now we got to heal ourselves too. So anybody that wants to be a part of that, you are welcome to join that.
Thank you for that, Rob. Mental health and society, something for y'all to chew on that. That's a whole like 3-course meal right there. So just think about that and let us know what you think. Like, send us some love and, you know, come chill with the homies. I want to just thank you, Sam, for being our first Glitch homie.
It was my pleasure. You guys are awesome. Awesome.
You fit right in with the homies, and we would definitely love to have you back. Yeah. Follow us, you guys, at The Bridge Millennial Podcast on Instagram. And my personal Instagram handle is Shannon, Shannon, _Ashlia. That's Ashlia. Show us some love.
Yes. You guys can find me at Just Rob's World on Instagram. Pull up.
Yeah, and you guys can find me at Note to Sam. That's NoteTosam.
Yes.
Thank you, guys. Thank you all. We'll see you next time on the Bridge Millennial Podcast.
The bridge.
I can't. I really can't.